I want you to picture something that is probably sitting on a shelf in millions of homes right now, a trading card.
Oh, yeah, like a holographic superhero or a sports card.
Exactly, maybe a rookie baseball player.
Yeah.
It is made of cardboard. It fits in the palm of your hand. And honestly, from where I sit, dealing with manufacturing operations all day, it seems like the simplest object in the world to produce. I mean, you print it, you cut it, you stick it in a foil pack.
Right, it feels incredibly tangible, very static. It is just paper and ink.
That is exactly what I used to think. But today we are doing a deep dive into why that little piece of cardboard is actually a data modeling nightmare, like the kind of nightmare that breaks almost every standard software system out there.
It really does.
We are looking at this fascinating technical report on the architecture of a card manufacturing system. And honestly, coming from the factory floor side of things, I usually worry about, printers jamming or the foil stamper running out of material.
Yeah.
But this report argues the real problem isn't mechanical at all, it is mathematical.
It absolutely is. And honestly, it is not even just about trading cards. The report we're looking at today is essentially a masterclass in modeling reality when reality flat out refuses to be neat and tidy.
Which is always.
Right, exactly. We are talking about this core concept called fan out, fan in, and things like time travel and databases, and why standard off-the-shelf ERP software essentially just chokes when you ask it to track this kind of manufacturing.
So let's start with that core tension, because this is something I see in logistics and operations constantly. The report calls it the fan out, fan in problem. Now, to a software person, that probably sounds like network traffic.
Yeah, server requests and microservices.
Right. But here we are talking about physical goods. So what is the actual disconnect between, say, a standard off-the-shelf system and this specific factory floor?
Well, think about how most standard manufacturing software, like your typical SAP or Oracle ERPs, think about how they are designed. They're built from the ground up to track batches.
Okay, batches.
Yeah, so if you are making soda, you have a giant vat of syrup. Or if you're building furniture, you have a box of 5,000 screws. You don't care about screw number 42 specifically.
Right, they're fungible. One screw is as good as another. If I drop one on the floor, I just reach into the bin and grab another one. No harm, no foul. My inventory count just goes down by one.
Exactly. But in the trading card industry, and this is where it gets pretty wild, you start with a single sheet of paper. That is your unit of work. That one sheet goes through an industrial cutter. That moment right there, that is the fan out.
The explosion.
Yes. Suddenly, that one tracked object, that one sheet, physically explodes into 18 or 50 or 100 individual card units.
And here is the kicker for the operations side. Each one of those cards needs to be tracked individually from that exact moment on. Because, well, card number one might be a common card worth maybe 5 cents, but card number seven from that exact same sheet could be a rare holographic foil insert worth $500.
Precisely. They suddenly have completely different values, different processing steps, and entirely different destinies. They essentially have their own lives now.
But then at the very end of the line, they have to come back together.
Right. That is the fan-in part. They have to reassemble to form a perfect, totally validated set or pack.
And if you mess that up, say card number seven from sheet 104 is missing, or a worker accidentally swaps it with card number seven from sheet 105, you have a defective product. And in the collector world, provenance is everything.
Oh, absolutely.
If I ship a pack that is supposed to have the rare insert and it's missing, that is a massive customer support nightmare.
And this is exactly where standard software completely fails. Because standard software stops at the count, it looks at the cutter and says, great, you made 18 cards.
It gives you a quantity.
Right? It doesn't tell you card number seven is currently at the foil stamping station, but card number eight actually fell on the floor and is ruined. That spatial and historical gap is what this architecture is trying to fill. We need a system that guarantees zero error traceability without, and I think this is a really key phrase from the report, without over-engineering the architecture from day one.
Which is the trap everyone falls into. I have seen IT departments look at this level of complexity on the floor and immediately want to build like a distributed microservices mesh with a dozen message queues. And suddenly we have a system that costs millions of dollars just to maintain.
And the report just screams, stop, do not do that.
Thank goodness.
Yeah.
So let's look at the first principles the report establishes, because
Yeah.
it makes a statement that I really think applies to a lot more than just trading cards. It says this system isn't just software, it is a mathematical record of physical objects changing state over time.
I really love that framing. It really grounds the whole discussion. We aren't just moving bits around in a cloud somewhere. We are modeling physics. An object has an identity. It is entirely unique. It has a state, like, is it cut? Is it foiled? And it has lineage. Where did it actually come from?
And this is where the report threw me a massive curveball.
Yeah.
I fully expected comparisons to, I don't know, book printing or packaging. But it compares trading cards to semiconductor manufacturing.
It is such a brilliant analogy, though. Think about a silicon wafer. It is one big, incredibly pure disk of silicon.
Right.
You do all this incredibly expensive processing on that single disk, the lithography, the chemical etching, and then at the very end of the line, you slice it, you dice it into hundreds of tiny individual microchips or dies.
So in this analogy, the wafer is the sheet and the die is the card.
Exactly. And just like with trading cards, you need to know exactly which chip came from which specific part of the wafer. Because if a chip fails a quality test 3 weeks later, the engineer needs to know.
They need to find out why.
Right. They need to know, oh, that defective chip came from the top right quadrant of wafer 402, which was processed in oven B. You have to trace the defect back to the absolute source.
Because maybe oven B has a cold spot in the top right corner. That is classic root cause analysis for operations. If you don't have that data, you're flying blind.
Totally. If you just tossed all the finished chips into a big plastic bucket like you do with screws, you would never find the root cause. You would just keep churning out bad chips. And the trading card industry has that exact same strict requirement. To solve it, the report says you need what they call deterministic IDs.
Let's drill into that for a second. Deterministic IDs. Because normally when a dev team builds a database for me, they just assign a random UUID, you know, one of those ridiculously long strings of letters and numbers. Or just an auto-incrementing number like 1, 2, 3. Why doesn't that work here?
I mean, it works fine for the database itself, but it is completely useless for the actual human standing on the factory floor. A deterministic ID means the ID itself actually tells you the history of the object. The report suggests a format like J1044-S003-07.
Okay, let me decode that based on the floor operations. That'll be Job 1044, sheet 3, position 7.
Boom. Just by looking at the ID printed on the back of the card, you know its entire origin story.
So I don't need an operator to scan a barcode, query the server, wait for the spotty factory Wi-Fi to connect, and read a screen.
No, not at all. The physical spatial reality is encoded directly into the data itself. That is so much smarter and more resilient than a random database key. It permanently links the physical world to the digital record. It even survives a network outage.
Okay, so we understand the physical nightmare now. We have these objects exploding into pieces and then needing to come back together perfectly. Now let's talk about how you actually model this in code. The report spends a huge amount of time on domain modeling and something called the ubiquitous language.
Yes, this is straight out of domain-driven design, or DDD. The core idea is incredibly simple, but very hard to execute. The code must speak the exact same language as the factory floor.
So no translation layer.
Right. If the machine operator calls it a sheet, the software code calls the class a sheet. If the operator calls the slicing process a cut, the code fires an event called cut.
The report specifically warns developers against using generic, lazy terms like item or object.
Oh, heavily. Because a word like item is completely meaningless. If I'm a new developer on the team and I see a variable called item in the code base, I have to mentally translate it every single time. Is it a sheet? Is it a card? A box? A pallet?
And that translation gap is where the bugs happen.
Exactly. If you mean a card unit, you have to type card unit.
I see this constantly in real-world operations. The warehouse team calls a wooden platform a skid, the procurement team calls it a pallet, and the software system calls it a transport unit. And nobody knows what anybody's actually talking about during a crisis.
Right. And in software architecture, that kind of conversational confusion directly leads to data corruption. You absolutely have to synchronize the vocabulary before you write a single line of code.
So let's talk about that cut event again. In the software model, this is described as a destructive transformation, which honestly sounds a bit dramatic for just using an automated pair of scissors.
It sounds dramatic, but it is intense from a data perspective. Think about it. Inside the database, the sheet effectively stops existing as a tracked, moving entity. It is archived, it doesn't move forward to the next station. In its place, N new aggregates, the card units, are suddenly born.
And this leads to a massive architectural decision. Who is the boss here? Is the parent sheet still the boss of the cards, or are the cards their own bosses now?
This is the classic aggregate root question in system design, and the report is very firm on this point. Once cut, the card unit must become its own aggregate root.
Why does that matter so much, though? Why can't the database just let the sheet keep a list of its cards? From a top-down hierarchy standpoint, that makes sense.
It totally makes sense logically, but it completely fails operationally. Imagine if the sheet was still the boss of the data. To update the status of just card number one, the database would have to lock the entire row for the whole sheet.
Ah, okay. I see where this is going. Locking is really bad for factory throughput.
Exactly. Now imagine card number one is sitting at the QA station being inspected by a human, and card number two is physically over at the foil stamping station getting a shiny gold border. If the scanners at both stations try to update the main sheet record at the exact same millisecond,
you get a collision.
You get massive database contention, you get deadlocks, the software literally freezes.
And my physical manufacturing line stops. I cannot have the foil stamper standing around waiting for a screen to load just because the QA guy is typing in a defect code across the room.
Exactly. By making them independent aggregate routes, card number one can live its entire life without ever checking in with card number two. They leave the nest.
That makes total practical sense. But, and here is the fan-in problem rearing its head again eventually. They do have to come back. We need to assemble a complete set for the customer. This is the Humpty Dumpty problem. How does the software put them back together?
This is arguably the absolute hardest part of the entire system. You have 18 independent tracked agents running around the factory floor, and you need to ensure that exactly one of each specific position lands in the exact same box before you shrink wrap it.
The report contrasts two ways to handle this in software: the Saga and the Process Manager.
Right. These are two very different architectural patterns for handling long-running, complex processes. Think of a Saga as a choreographed dance. Everyone just memorizes the steps. When the music plays, I move left, you move right. It is totally decentralized. There is no one standing there shouting orders.
So card number one scans in and says, I'm done. And card number two says, I'm done. And they sort of, I don't know, just hope they meet up in the box.
Basically, yeah. In a Saga, the logic is scattered everywhere. But the problem is, who actually checks if the set is complete? Who stops the conveyor belt if card number seven is missing? In a Saga, that centralized rule is really hard to enforce. A process manager, on the other hand, is an orchestra with a dedicated conductor.
I like that analogy.
The conductor, the process manager software, has the master sheet music. They know exactly who should be playing what note and when.
And for this problem, where quality control and completeness are paramount, you definitely need the conductor.
You absolutely need a process manager. Because if card number seven falls off the belt and goes missing, the process manager notices immediately. The conductor looks at the state of the assembly and says, hey, wait, I have 17 cards here. I am missing position seven. I will explicitly not allow this set to move to the packing phase until a number seven arrives.
It is a stateful coordinator. It enforces the business rule of 100% completeness.
Exactly. It holds the line.
Now, speaking as an ops manager, I have to bring up the messy reality of the physical floor. Things break. Cards get jammed in the rollers, they get scratched by a tool, somebody spills coffee on them. What actually happens in the system if card number seven gets destroyed?
This is where that ubiquitous language we talked about saves us again. A typical disconnected developer might look at that and just say, oh, just run a delete command on the row in the database and create a new card to replace it.
But you absolutely cannot do that. That destroys the real-world history. If I delete the row, I lose the financial fact that we wasted expensive foil material. My yield reports at the end of the month will be completely wrong.
Right. You have to model the ugly reality. The card is voided. Voided is a valid status. It is a domain event. And then the factory might produce a replacement card. The process manager needs to be smart enough to know that replacement card number seven is now a perfectly valid substitute for original card number seven.
So the process manager isn't hard-coded to look for a specific database ID string anymore. It's looking to fill a specific slot in the set.
Correct. It needs position seven filled. It frankly doesn't care if it's the original or a manager-approved replacement, but it absolutely needs to record exactly why it changed. If you just treat a ruined card as a software bug and delete the data, you permanently lose that traceability.
Okay, so we have got our domain model. We know how to track the items without locking up the floor. Now let's talk about the database itself. The report recommends an architecture called CQRS Ready. Now, usually when I hear CQRS in strategy meetings with the tech team, I hear things like microservices, Kafka, eventual consistency, and massive headaches. Basically, I hear this project is going to take 2 years and run over budget.
I know, I know. You and every other operations manager, it is usually a total recipe for premature, crippling complexity.
But the report actually says don't do that.
Right, it says don't do that yet. The strong recommendation is something called stage one architecture. You just use a single boring database like Postgres. You do everything synchronously in one single transaction. Keep it incredibly simple.
But there's a twist, right?
There is. Even though it is one database, you logically separate the write model from the read model in the code.
Explain that for me.
Okay.
Because usually those are just different SQL queries running on the exact same table.
Not here. In this system, the write model is your unchangeable history. It is an append-only log. Honestly, this is the most crucial takeaway of the entire architectural report. You never, ever use the update command to change a status.
Wait, really? So if a card moves from the cutting station to the foil station, I don't just change the status column from cutting to foil.
No, you absolutely do not. You insert a brand new event record saying card unit entered station. The old data from the cutting station stays exactly where it is, completely untouched.
So the database just grows and grows infinitely.
It grows, yes, but disk space is cheap and it preserves the absolute truth. The current state of the card is calculated just by summing up all those past events. Think of it like a bank account. You don't just have a single cell in a database somewhere that says your balance is $500.
Yeah.
You have a long list of transactions, deposits, withdrawals, fees. The $500 is just the math applied at the end. It's a left fold or a reducer.
Okay, that makes perfect sense to me. If the bank just overwrote my balance every time I bought a coffee without showing me the transaction history, I would immediately switch banks.
Exactly. You would never trust them.
Okay, so that is the right model. But if I'm a floor manager and I want to load a dashboard showing all 50,000 cards currently sitting in the foil station, asking the database to sum up millions of individual historical events on the fly just to load my screen, that is going to be painfully slow.
Oh, it would be agonizingly slow. And that is exactly why you have the read model. It is a completely separate table that looks exactly like a normal flat database table. It just has card ID, status, current location.
And you just update that flat table whenever a new event happens.
Yeah. Exactly. In the exact same database transaction. So when your scanner saves the new event, saying card unit entered station into the log, the code also updates that read model table to say status is foil.
Oh, I see. So you get the blazing speed of a normal database for your UI,
yeah,
but you keep the perfect, immutable history of the event log in the background.
Yes, that is what it means to be CQRS ready. You have the logical separation of concerns, but you don't have the horrific complexity of distributed systems and message queues. Everything is consistent immediately.
And the report is really strict about exactly when you should eventually move to stage two, which is the full-blown, physically separate databases and complex architecture.
Yes, it gives two very specific signals for when to upgrade. Signal one is query shape impedance. That basically means, are your developers spending all their time writing crazy, convoluted SQL joins just to build a simple new dashboard for you? If so, your read model needs to physically change.
And what is signal two?
Contention. Are those heavy dashboard reports you're running actually slowing down the barcode scanners on the factory floor? If a manager reading the data is literally blocking the line worker who is trying to write the data, then and only then do you physically separate the databases.
I really love the stern warning the report gives here. It says, "We want to be modern" is not a valid reason to introduce eventual consistency.
It is such a good warning. Complexity is a massive cost. If you can do it in Postgres with one single transaction, just do it. Don't build a spaceship to cross the street.
Now, here's where it gets really, really interesting for me. Why go through all this trouble? Why force the developers to keep this massive append-only event log of every single thing that ever happened? Why not just overwrite the status and save the disk space? The report says the ultimate payoff is actually an AI layer.
Yes. This is the really forward-looking part of the design. We talk about AI and manufacturing like it is magic, but AI desperately needs data, and not just any data. It needs deep historical context.
Hmm.
If you just use standard CR root operations and overwrite your data, if you just update status from A to B and erase A, you are actively destroying your history. You are permanently deleting your future AI training data.
Because you don't know when it happened or how long it took to transition or who specifically was logged in when it happened. You just know where the card is right now.
Exactly. But if you have this rigorously structured event log 6 months from now, you can feed that entire unchangeable history into a machine learning model. You can ask incredibly complex business questions like, do foil adhesion failures systematically spike on Tuesday afternoons? Or which specific machine operator has the highest first pass yield rate for this one specific type of holographic cardstock?
Or does a slight change in the shop's ambient humidity affect the precision of the cutting machine 3 steps later?
Yes. If you captured the events, you can answer that. The report makes a really great distinction here between unstructured logs and true domain events. A server log is just plain text. It says, you know, error at line 40. That is mostly garbage for an AI trying to optimize a factory. A domain event is a highly structured business fact, it looks like. QA, result recorded. Result is fail. Reason is adhesion. Operator is Bob.
That is absolute gold for operations. You are basically building the training set for the AI right now, today, whether you are actually using an AI yet or not.
It's totally future-proofing the business. If you build the CQRS-ready architecture, you are treating your data as a primary asset, not just a temporary byproduct of getting the cards out the door.
So we have covered the physics of the cards, the ubiquitous language, the CQRS architecture, and the AI future. The report wraps up with this master sequence. It's a recommended build order for any engineering team trying to actually implement this.
And notice what comes first. Phase zero.
Define the language. No yep. code whatsoever.
No code, just a plain text file called decisions.md. You lock the developers and the floor managers in a room, and you agree on exactly what a sheet is. You agree on exactly what void means. If you get this vocabulary wrong, no amount of fancy Python or Java will save your system.
Then you move to phase one, pure logic.
Yeah.
And still no database.
Still no database. You just write the pure math, a function that takes a sheet and returns a list of cards. You test it all in memory. If the core business logic holds up, then you finally add the Postgres database in phase two.
And then, and only then, do you build the API and the user interface. The UI is dead last.
Dead last.
That seems so backwards compared to how software is usually bought and built.
Yeah.
Everyone I know, every stakeholder, immediately wants to see the screen first.
Yeah.
They want to see a pretty button they can click.
I know, but the report literally calls the UI a trap.
A trap? How yeah. so?
If you build the UI first, you inevitably start designing your back-end data to perfectly fit the screen. You say, oh, I need these three specific metrics on this dashboard, so I'll just make a database table with exactly those three columns. You are actively distorting the messy reality of the factory floor just to fit a web page layout.
Wow. You are letting the front end tail wag the back end dog.
Exactly. You have to model the actual physical reality first. The UI is just one temporary, subjective way to look at that reality.
That is such a powerful lesson, even completely outside of manufacturing.
Mm-hmm.
It really reminds me of how often we build operational tools that don't actually match the real workflow of the people using them just because the software looked good in a demo.
It really is a universal problem. Software architecture isn't about picking the coolest tech stack or the trendiest framework. It is about creating a high-fidelity mirror image of reality. It needs to be precise enough that you can answer questions you haven't even thought to ask yet.
That is the real light bulb moment for me.
Mm.
We aren't just building a tracking system. We are building a perfect digital twin of the factory floor, event by microscopic event.
And that digital twin is what eventually allows you to optimize, to predict failures, and to truly automate. But it all starts with respecting the physical data.
Well, I will tell you this. The next time I hold a simple trading card, I am definitely going to think about the fan-out, fan-in data nightmare that made it possible.
And you should definitely check the ID string printed on the back. It might tell you a pretty crazy story.
It just might. But here is a thought I want to leave you with. Building on this whole idea of the software being a perfect mirror of reality, if we build this digital twin so perfectly and the AI starts showing us exactly where our inefficiencies are, what happens when the physical factory starts changing its layout and its human behaviors just to make the software's event log look cleaner? At what point does the factory start mirroring the software instead of the other way around? Something to think about. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive into the architecture of manufacturing. It is wild what goes on behind the scenes. We will catch you on the next one.